Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode 18 for January 2009. Happy New Year to you. My name's Paul Davison and this is a monthly podcast celebrating the music of Roy Harper. First of all, for those of you that have got New Year's hangovers, here's something to wake you up a little bit.
The milkman rides his clanging cow, the sun explodes above the brow, the village venom's daily vow, that can't tell when from anyhow, has seized a grip upon its plough, and knows how much to raise a brow, when steps are taken to allow a thoughtful thought to take a bow. But all the time, it's now somehow, all the time, it's now. And Sergeant Sunshine's made the choice. Sergeant Sunshine smokes the choice. Sergeant Sunshine struck for light outside the city hall. With the sky so blue to fall into and disappear. Johnny's mum is heard to say, a stitch in ten saves nine Australian. Hey look, even the sun kneels down to pray. Sergeant Sunshine knows his faults, he rides the endless next last waltz, says he loves his liver salts, and the moon speaks English, true or false. And Sergeant Sunshine's made the point. Sergeant Sunshine's made the joint. Sergeant Sunshine struck the light outside the city hall. Sergeant Sunshine, Sergeant Sunshine.
So that was Sergeant Sunshine from Roy's album Folk Joke Opus. In this episode, we will have a brief news update. We'll have part one of a two-part interview with Lynn Branson. We'll have the A to Z of Harper. This time it's Q. Goodness knows what we're going to do for that. A little bit of listener feedback and, of course, a selection of music as well. Now, a bit of news, first of all. There's some more Nick Harper tour dates posted on the stormcock.net forums. If you haven't checked them out yet, go and have a look over there. There's a nice tour forming there. James Hanley posted to the Stormcock top albums of 2008 yesterday, and very interesting reading actually. It covers the readership of the forums and also of the Stormcock mailing list, so there's quite a lot of people contributing to that and saying what albums they thought were worthy of note in the last year, rules being that it could be a new release in 2008 or a reissue that came out in 2008. And I'm going to put a link to that list in the show notes again. Now, I'm not going to read it out here because it would be a bit long-winded, but it's worth looking at. The third thing I wanted to mention was the sad death of David Graham in December. David Graham was a very pioneering acoustic guitarist and was an influence on a lot of people. And I was listening to one of the albums I've got of his, and very striking that some of the acoustic guitar work sort of turned up in other places, particularly Jimmy Page obviously ripped a lot of the stuff off for White Summer in particular. Davey was very influential and a very modest man, and had been gigging a lot in recent years after a period of time not doing very much. And it was all going very well, so I'm very sad that he's no longer around. Now, before we get stuck into the interview, I'd just like to say one or two things about how the podcast went in 2008. As I've said before, the podcast was a bit of an experiment, really, and it was a bit of a vanity exercise, I suppose. I just wanted to get the chance to say stuff about Roy's music and peripheral issues on the records, as it were, and play some fun music and have a good time. But it's gone very well. And of course, in 2008, we had Roy himself doing a very long interview in three parts, and we had Matt Churchill on here, we have Dave Cochran, the bass player, but also a lot of people behind the scenes, people like Darren Crisp, and a lot of very intelligent fans who had some very interesting things to say. And in 2009, I hope to continue with this kind of idea, which is to have a variety of types of guests. I've got some people lined up already, which I think are going to be quite interesting. I can't promise you the big name stars. I'll do what I can to get them, but I'm hoping to get Nick Harper back at some point, particularly when he's got a new album out to talk about. I think that would be worth doing. And I'm trying to hunt down one or two other musicians that have played with Roy in the past, and a couple of other people, but obviously I can't say who I'm trying to get because it spoils the surprise. But I hope that we'll have a good 2009. It's interesting doing a podcast that's so focused on one artist. Most podcasts tend to be a little bit more general, at least in the music genre. I listen to a lot of fiction stuff and a lot of fan stuff of TV programs and so on, and they're also very focused, and there is a danger about becoming too specialised and simply running out of things to say. And if and when that happens, of course, I'll just stop and do something else. But at the moment, there's no sign of that happening, and I'm very encouraged by that. And I'd also like to say thank you to all of you who have contacted me in various forms over the last year to offer words of encouragement, give me ideas of things to do. It's very much appreciated. It's nice to know that the podcast is listened to by so many of you, actually, and you keep coming back for more. So gluttons for punishment is the phrase that springs to mind there. Talking of podcasting, I'd just like to say hello to Dave Burnham, who was interviewed in 2008 along with his wife Sue for the podcast. Long-time Harper fans, Dave is in the middle of producing a science fiction story podcast of his own short stories, and I went down to Brighton with my wife Vicky a few weeks ago to give him the sort of masterclass of what everything I know about podcasting, which took about 90 seconds. Well, actually, no, it took about an afternoon. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what Dave comes up with. At the moment, I don't have a website address to point people to, but in the next podcast, I will make sure that we do that and even run a trailer if Dave has one. But I just wanted to say, Dave, good luck with it all. I'm really, really looking forward to hearing what you have to come up with. All right, on to the interview now, and I have Lynn Branson. I got Lynn down in the pod cave in my little basement studio in December to have a long chat, and we actually talked for a couple of hours. We really got, you know, wandering all over the place, and Lynn was quite keen on having me chop it down. But I listened to the first half of it yesterday while preparing for the podcast, and I really like it. We covered a lot of really good stuff, and I think it's very interesting. So I'm going to leave it fairly verbose, just chop out the obvious mistakes. Lynn, in case some of you don't know, is Nick Harper's PR lady. She's known on the forums as Harper PR, in fact. So that's the sort of business angle that she's coming from, but she's also a fan, and we talk in the interview about how that all started and how she got involved. I think it's very interesting. So here we go. Okay, this month I'm lucky enough to have Lynn Branson in the pod cave here in person for an interview. So hello, Lynn.
Well, hello. Thank you for asking me.
My pleasure. Now, before we get started, let's have the sort of potted introduction to Lynn, who you are, what you do, anything else you want to tell the audience.
Okay. I suppose I'm the Harper PR, even though that's not my company name any longer. That's what I'm probably known to have become known to Harper fans as.
Right.
Nick Harper. I do not, sadly, do any PR for Roy. That's another side entirely. Mm. So it's just for Nick, so that's what I do. But I do also now PR for a number of other artists, music artists, and I also work with artists who are totally unrelated to music and property. And I still like to think of myself as a journalist, as a feature writer, and keep my hand in doing that and going out and doing what you're doing at this precise moment and talking to people and asking them the usual questions about their book, film, record, whatever it is they may want to plug.
Your PR agency's got a name now, hasn't it? What's it called?
It has got a name, yes. It's called Say It Now.
Mm-hmm.
Just partly because I like the S-I-N.
Right. Okay, I hadn't thought of that.
It's simple. I thought about lots of names, and there were lots of things I could have, I was thinking about, and either that somebody already had that name when I Googled it. They already had that name, so I couldn't use that. Would get a little bit complicated. So that just sort of talking to a couple of friends, and we just sort of had now. Because, like, Say It Now, yes, get that word out about that artist. About
it's actually
that.
Hard to think of original working. Things sometimes.
Yes, it
everybody's
is,
done
yeah.
it already. You know?
It was that's why it was quite easy with Harper PR. It yeah. wasn't intended to be that. It's just I started off doing that, and I needed a name simply to put out on things that I was doing at the beginning. And so that came, but then it's kind of stuck for a few years. But I didn't, now sort of working with other artists, it seemed a little bit, it didn't seem quite right to be working with other artists
right.
and using another artist's name. Plus, some people were thinking that Harper was my surname, and it would get a little bit confusing sometimes
oh, I
when
yes.
I was put down on lists or something, and my name wouldn't be on it, and then I'd find out I was down as Harper, and so I just thought, you know, it would just
it
you know, make
Harper,
it obvious
yeah.
that was the company name, my name, something completely different, artist names.
Right.
It's all quite separate.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about how the PR stuff works in a minute.
Okay.
Now, I do notice on your MySpace page that it says you're, now is it 102 years old now? 101? Something like that?
100 years old.
It's what it says on your MySpace
yes.
profile. So we'll have an awful lot to talk about over things that have happened in the last century. I'm just pulling your leg.
Well, you see, a lady should never reveal
well,
her
no,
age.
Quite so.
Partly, I think, on MySpace, there's other networking sites. I'm very aware of just sort of how much information has been given out, and also the safety aspect, as I think a lot of people should be, and that, you know, I'm not giving too much that, you know, I've had that experience of having, you know, sort of identity
I think
fraud, and, I sort of think, well, nobody needs to know, really, how old I am. I'm old enough.
Well, when all these networks started up, everybody was giving away all their personal information willy-nilly. And, it, you know, I kept thinking, if I was out to impersonate somebody, I've got a lot of information about
absolutely.
Them. And I think,
absolutely.
You know, you are right to be a little bit, not paranoid, just sensible. Anyway, let's talk about music, first of all. How did your interest in music start? Do you remember what the first record was? Do you remember when you first saw somebody play? What's your sort of early musical memories?
Well, Paul, it was a long time ago. music, I guess I'd had that from, as a small child. My mother had a love of music and would write songs, none that she had published or anything, but she would, that was an interest for her, writing songs and music. So I can remember from very early age that she would be there with you know, one of those old tape decks, I can't remember what they're called, but the old reel tape,
reel to reel,
one of those, and she'd be singing and writing these songs and recording it. So I
was that just a hobby for her then, or did she actually
it was a hobby. Something that she enjoyed, so that I can remember. And you know, we always had, you know, the sort of radio on, and sort of as a child, like a lot of people did growing up, you know, Top of the Pops each week was a thing you had to watch, and you know, loved it. But as for the first record, I suppose it was one of those children's records that they used to have back in those days, which was the Yorkshire, some of the races, what was that? Those sort of children's kind of songs. And I suppose it was something like that. But the first one I actually bought, I don't know, I really can't remember. The same as I was actually thinking a few nights ago about what was the first gig I actually went to, and that's hard to remember as well. I think, although I can't be absolutely clear about it, I think it was either the second job that I worked at, which was a music agency and management. Right. I think it was possibly one of two bands, either band, probably no one have heard of either. And one was Nicky James Band. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what, they did some tours in the States with the Moody Blues, and Nicky wrote with a couple of the guys, and I was going out with the manager at the time, so that's why I went down to that gig. I remember it was somewhere in South London. It was either that was the first one I went to, or a band I can't remember the name of, but I know that Snowy White
was with
them, who then obviously went on to bigger and better things later on. Mm. I can't remember what the name of them is, but it was at Global Village under Chancra Station, which is just down the side of anyway. So it was one of those two that it would have been.
I can tell you my first record, which was, the first LP was Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield, but I can't remember my first gig either. I really can't. You've got me thinking now.
It's hard, isn't it?
I mean, it is difficult.
You get them at the time and you don't sort of think, I might need to remember these for later posterity.
No.
Well, one of the reasons why now, and often people say to me when they see me at Nick's gigs, and it's usually only Nick's that I do it, I'm always scribbling away there, and people say, what is it you're writing, down there? And what I do at every gig that I've been to, I'm writing down the set list. Just because, when Nick brings out this book, later in life, his biography, he may need them.
You'll be able to supply the missing gaps.
Say, I've got quite a few of them here.
I mean, you'd get people that have these scrapbooks of everything they've ever been to. There was a, I don't know whether you saw, there was a guy in the news this week or last week who had been to thousands of gigs. And he was talking about all the gigs he'd been to. And they had a photo of him against lots of memorabilia and so on. And he's obviously the sort of person that keeps a scrapbook full of everything he's been to. I'm quite bad at that as well. Although when I started getting, some might say, obsessive about the Roy stuff a couple of decades ago, I used to write down set lists just so I could post them to the mailing list and tell people what songs have been played and so on. But I've never gone into that kind of quite that obsessive nature as well. But I know there are people listening who have got scrapbooks because I've seen them. So those people are out there.
I think it's quite useful because you never know where in the future they may come in handy. It's also nice to sort of, if you're looking back to think, well, how many times have I heard that song in live performance? And just...
Yeah.
Little things like that, that sort of quite interesting, if you have that kind of mind to think, or where did I first hear X song? Which gig would that have been at? And obviously, if you've got a list there, it's something that you can refer back to.
Mm. Well, the interesting thing about music, I'm already distracting myself from the list of questions here. But
the point, man.
One of the things about music is when you listen to something, if it had a strong effect, or you first heard it when something very important was happening in your life or something that you really remember very well, it has that kind of associative effect. So, I can listen to, various of Roy's albums, and I can remember what I was up to at that time in my life and the sorts of things I was doing.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really good sort of associative memory thing that music does. And I think that's why some people hold songs so dearly, even though to other people the song has little merit, because they associate it with a really good time in their life or whatever. It's one of the strong things.
It's a bit
things,
like
I
a Proustian thing, isn't it? That you sort of, you hear a song and it takes you back to a certain time in your life, maybe a certain relationship. That's why songs and music and lyrics are so powerful, because they can bring up a lot of happy memories and perhaps not so.
Well, but, no, not so as well.
But as you say, from different points in your life, you know, you can remember certain songs of, you know, the age you were at and what was going on in your life at that time.
I was listening to Ultravox a couple of weeks ago because Ultravox, one of their albums was the third or fourth album I ever bought. I can't remember. And it's been remastered, so I was listening to it, and that, you know, suddenly I was back as a 13-year-old sat in my room with a little cassette player. It really, you know, brought it back. Anyway, back on topic. So early days, obviously, you got an appreciation for music, as you've said, because it was around anyway. It was in the family and so on and so forth. I know from your MySpace profile that you've done a lot of journalism outside of the music area as well. But what I'd like to know is how you got involved with what's led to your PR work. How did you first meet or listen to one or other of the Harpers? That's the first question. It must have been Roy, presumably, the first Harper that you got exposed to, was it?
I have never been exposed to either of Harper. I deny that.
That was a bad
choice. Someone contacted me the other day and said, oh, I saw on MySpace you have a dalliance with Nick Harper. I said, I've never had a dalliance. I deny it. I do not dally. okay. I left school and worked for a music, that's how I got into music in the first place. I worked for a music paper, a music publishing company, which at that time published a weekly paper called Sounds.
Which, oh, of course, yes.
At that time, you had the big three. It was Melody Maker, NME, and then the new kid on the block, Sounds, came along, which dealt sort of with people like Bowie, Genesis and the Stones, Sabbath, that kind of music. So I went to work there as a very lowly junior messenger and really learning to work the switchboard and doing that kind of things. And I actually worked my guy who was a few years older than me, but was still sort of like a higher up junior, as it were, was Pete McCaskey, who some people may know the name because then he went on to actually be a music journalist himself.
And
I just remembered that because reading the Mick Wall's biography of Led Zeppelin recently, and he's got a mention in that. I thought, back to those Sounds days. So that's where I started off, and after that I went on to work for various music agencies and record companies, so I'd been in the business. Now, where am I sort of coming up to the point where I heard of Roy? I was working for a company called Bron, and Bron had both a music agency, recording studio, record company, management.
The whole thing.
What else did he do? It was like everything in one. So, and as you know, if you work in that kind of environment, you get lots of freebies, lots of tickets to different things. That period in time, it was just sort of around the punk explosion, what was happening then. It was the Clash, it was the Buzzcocks, it was also this lot of new Irish guys that had just pitched up in London and recorded their first album in our studio, who were the Boomtown Rats. So that was the kind of thing that I was going at. Because we worked in Camden next door to the Roundhouse, we were very close to Dingwalls. So, every other night, at least we'd be down sort of ligging at Dingwalls with the crowd. You know, there'd be Elvis Costello there, Johnny Rotten. And this was the kind of, kind of music that I was listening to. But a friend of mine who worked for a while at the same company, she liked this guy called Roy Harper. I'd never seen or heard him. But she wondered, she said, he was doing this gig in London, and did I want to go along, you know, with her? So I thought, I'll do that. Because, you see, I thought, Paul, she meant she had free tickets. Right, so I thought, I'll try it. But what I actually found out was that I had to pay for the tickets. They weren't free.
At all.
She was just saying, I've got some tickets. So I found I was in the position I was going along, and probably the tickets were probably like 2 and 6 pence at the time, you know, not like £20 or something as they are today. But I found myself in the position that I was paying to go and see this guy who I'd never seen or heard, had no idea what he was going to be like, and probably thought, I'm going to hate this, you know, but I've said I'll
you
go
said
now,
you'll go, so,
so
you went.
I really have to do it. So went along to this gig, and was it the Apollo that's at Victoria that is now just a theatre? Was it the Apollo or the Astoria? I can't remember what it was called, but I know that was, or the New Victoria. It was something like that at Victoria anyway. It's huge theatre.
Right.
And anyway, just went in and was just totally blown away. It was like nothing I'd seen or heard before. And I can't remember now what songs he actually did that night. I mean, it may have been things like When an Old Cricketer, Another Day, 12 Hours of Sunset. And
so
it was
we
just
are
like,
talking
wow.
late 70s, are we? Late 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was still in my teens then. I was not well into my 30s at that time, you know. But
yeah.
Yes, and it was just wow. And just came out transfixed by it. And not that I left behind all, you know, the Rats and Thin Lizzy and all the other stuff that
well, you
I
don't
liked
have
that
to.
Time,
I mean, that's something
that
people
something
do with
else.
Music. They tend to think you have to just like one genre, and you don't. Don't at all.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I mean, I had listened to other. I mean, I had listened to people like Leonard Cohen, who I still like to
Laughing
this day.
Men. Yeah.
But it was Roy from that one gig that he was the first actual music artist that started going on these long treks around the country to see rather than just seeing someone in
London.
Oh,
I see, yes.
Because I can remember, I don't know when it was, I think it may have been on that same year, that going up to Nottingham to see him and other places around, and that was the first one, just totally enamoured. And then we sort of ventured backstage to meet him, and I can remember because, I mean, people don't believe it of me, but I still am. There is a certain degree of shyness and and certainly as a child, I never spoke to anybody, you know. I was really, really, you know, just colour up, and I was terribly shy. And I was still, you know, even in my teens, 20s, I'm still very shy. So you can imagine sort of going backstage and trying to talk to Roy, and I just was standing there and sort of being like, gosh, sort of bit in awe of him and not really knowing what to say. And it's all sort of, just strange. But, very, very nice, very nice man. And again, just sort of got to know him. You know, we sort of met a few times. And, just... That was how my first, and obviously at that time, sort of getting all the old, his earlier albums and earlier, I mean, Pete Jenner gave me some earlier press.
That's right. We have one of those. We have one of those up on
and
the
of
website.
Of course, at that time, and on the flashes from album that, and on in interviews that he'd mentioned his son Nicky, and there was a picture of the little Nicky with Edward the cat sitting on his lap, just as I've got a cat sitting on my lap.
Yes, you've got one of our cats on your lap helping with the interview.
That, you know, little did I think that when Nicky was all grown up, that I'd get to know him. You know, that was something that I just never entered.
Well, you wouldn't think that, would you?
Head, no.
Yes. So, which leads obviously on to, when did you first see Nick play? When did you become aware that he was the major talent, which he undoubtedly is?
There was a long period during the 80s where I didn't see, kind of lost touch with Roy and didn't see him play live.
Well, the 80s were, some of the 80s were a tricky period for him as well, so...
Yeah,
you know.
And it was 93 that I saw that he was doing a gig at the Half Moon.
Oh, the infamous Half Moon, yes. The Black
and
Hole of Putney.
Just thought, okay, I haven't seen him for a long, long time. I'd like to go along to this. So I went along to that gig, and I can remember, I presume it would have been Darren Crisp, who was there on the door and selling the hors d'oeuvres magazine.
That's right.
And I can remember going in sort of and buying my ticket and picking up a couple of copies of this magazine, hors d'oeuvres. And I just want to make a point. Bring back hors d'oeuvres. Well, that's what I said.
I was just going to say that.
And I miss.
I really miss it as well. There's something about having a printed magazine
in your hand. And you can have a little art, you know, keep and lovingly, you know, in a little, you know, box or something. Mm. You can't do all this online stuff. Yes, it's much.
It's all
more
very well, but sometimes you just want.
So I, you know, had got the magazine. I remember sort of having a look through that. Anyway, went in to see the show, and I can remember that sort of almost as if it was yesterday, standing sort of at the back to the door. And I think I must have missed the start or something, because there was Roy obviously sitting to one side, and to his right was this other guy with a guitar.
I was probably at that gig as well, actually, because I used to go to all of the Putney gigs at that time because I lived in London. But yeah,
little did we know that we'd become so intimate many years later.
It's a funny world.
And I didn't know who, seeing this guy, I didn't know who he was, and I hadn't, as I said, maybe he'd introduced him at the start, but I'd missed that. So I kind of thought, could that be Nick?
Yeah. You know?
And I think sort of Roy was sort of maybe then partway through made some reference to sort of Nick or my son or...
That's right.
Something. So it sort of dawned on me, that must be Nick, all grown up, you know. and that was it, you know, saw the gig and went away with my copies of hors d'oeuvres. And there were sort of a couple of things happened after that, just sort of looking through the magazine. I sort of thought, I wonder, you know, if they've ever done an interview with Nick in the magazine. Because I thought, well, you know, maybe I could sort of ask whether they'd be interested, you know, and I could do that. Because also, you see, I was quite interested. I suppose I wanted to meet Nick just to see, because having sort of met Roy, and I was sort of quite a little bit curious as to what Nick was
how
like.
How he turned out, yeah.
So I contacted Darren and just put that to him, and he said, yeah, no, we haven't done an interview with Nick in the hors d'oeuvres. Yeah, okay, you know, well, I'll ask him, sort it out. So I think that probably went on for a couple of months, because as I know sort of now, Nick does take his time in getting around to things.
Yeah, sure.
And then I think I'd sent Roy a note and he'd responded and said that I think he'd been either in the States or something, but he was just back and he was doing this show in Brighton in the June of 1993. So this is then coming up to the June 1993. I hadn't done in the interview. This particular was the Stanmer festival, one day festival at the Heineken Festival at Stanmer.
Yes.
And Nick was doing his own solo, had his own solo spot earlier in the day, and then Roy later on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I decided to go down for that. Missed Nick's set and just caught Roy's.
Right.
But after the they finished, that was the first time I actually met Nick and spoke to him. And I think I sort of remember saying, well, you know, do you want to do this? Did Darren mention the interview to you? Do you want to do it? And he sort of said, yeah, you know, this was the Sunday. He said, yeah, give me a call tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. I met him on the Sunday, phoned him on the Monday, and we met to do the interview on the Tuesday.
Right.
And because I'd missed his set when I did the interview, of course, I think that was the first and only time that I've ever interviewed someone and not had anything to refer to, hadn't read that subject's book or seen their films or their TV shows or listened to their music.
Yeah, a bit of an awkward situation.
Because all I knew was that he was Nick Harper, he was Roy Harper's son. I didn't know, have anything else to go on. So that was the first
I hadn't realised that. I must have a copy of that in my archive somewhere then.
Yes, I'm sure you probably have. Ooh. And that was the first interview that Nick gave. I know there's been this sort of ongoing debate about where and when Nick's first solo gig
there's a bit of confusion
happened
about that. Yes.
But there's no disputing his first interview. That was with me for hors d'oeuvres in... I can't remember which issue it was out in now, but it was either towards the end of 93 it came out.
I do vaguely remember, because he'd sprung up by doing... He'd started doing Guitar Man or something on his own when he was accompanying Roy, and, you know, everybody thought, wow, fantastic. And then he obviously started writing songs, and I used to go and see him at Bunge's... Charing Cross Road, that tiny little basement.
I know.
And I saw him at, well, I've said this before, but I saw him at Zarathustra's in Clapham as well, which I think was his first proper gig. But anyway, whatever.
We won't go.
The thing I found interesting was that he obviously found it easier in the early days to play with Roy, and I suppose that makes sense because you've got two of you on stage and there's a kind of security in numbers almost. And it's a much different thing to do things solo. And he was palpably nervous in those first few gigs.
Oh, sure. You know, yeah, and, would be. Yeah. I mean, just getting back to those early songs, that Crazy Boy, which he wrote on the Saturday prior to the Sunday gig at Stammer, because I remember when I asking him, because I hadn't heard it, in that interview, to sort of, how does it go? Tell me the lines, and him sort of quoting some of the lines. And I always remember him saying, you know, it was written on the Saturday and performed on the Sunday, and it was that, and that was one of the first songs that I heard. Because after I did that interview, then I think it was a couple of weeks later, he did three of the Heineken festivals.
Yes,
the Brighton one, and then Nottingham, and then Preston, and then Nottingham. So. After it was a couple of weeks after the interview, I called up Darren and said, Darren, I think I'm going to come to Preston. You know, can you tell me what time I'm going to? He said, you're what? You're coming all the way to Preston just for like 20 minutes? And because in those days, I mean, I know a lot of Nick's fans sort of travel all around the country to see him, but that was, you know, I think quite unheard of. And I said, yeah. And in those days, you know, that's the trains on a Sunday were even worse than they are now. And I think it took me about 4 hours to get there, 4 hours to get back for 20 minutes on stage. And, but at Preston, that was the first time I actually saw Nick perform his own set. And it was a short and sweet set. And
yes.
I know Crazy Boy would have been in there, I think, Two-Way Thing, possibly. Mm. Radio Silence.
Oh, yeah.
And there was just something there that I can remember coming away from that Preston gig just being like, wow. Obviously, yes, and just getting back to what you think about Nick being, you know, he was very much a different, and those early performances, very, very much a different performer to what he is today,
yes.
which only comes, the confidence and only comes with experience. And but then, you know, there was none of the chat that was just a little bit, oh, this is the song he's called, and then on to the next song. And, you know, it was... But even then, you could tell that there was something there very different to Roy. But there was something there in its embryonic stage that was just...
Mm.
I thought, wow, this is... He is going to be something. He is going to take off. And I was just like... God, you know, I was just dying at that. And of course, you know, it was another year or so before he brought the EP out. So there was nothing there to take away and listen to. And it was, you know, I just wanted to hear more of these songs that I'd heard. I can remember that. And I was just totally enthused and wanting to... I know there were not necessarily being a PR, but I know that at that point I was just wanting to, what can I do? This guy is is fantastic and is going to be even more. So I want to do something. I want to be there at this beginning and see him grow. And what can I do? You know, I want to do something more. And I know, I don't think Darren was too pleased with me at the time. I can vaguely recall in my memory that I was sort of, prior to his doing the show at Nottingham, my getting onto Radio Nottingham and sort of telling them about this.
Oh, really?
Came to me then. And then I think they wanted to do an interview or something with him. And Darren contacted me saying, Lynn, what's going on here? My enthusiasm carrying me away. The ironic thing is that I didn't think it came together then, but the only thing is, like 12 years or 13 years later, I came back. I got him on Radio Nottingham. That was one of the first interviews.
Oh, he finally, yes.
So it took me a few years, but I got there in the end. But yeah, that was the last time then that I actually saw Nick play in that period was 95 at Bungie's, as you say, which was a tiny little place. And then even at that point he'd progressed quite a bit from those early years. You could tell he was feeling more at home with the guitar around his neck and was happy, and particularly because obviously he had people gaining a little following, you know, friends that would come along. He was feeling a little bit more at ease now, and you know, you could see that he was polishing up his act, and you think, yeah, you know, there's things that are going to happen.
The music was becoming, well, even better, but there was also the kind of repartee and the general sort of ambience of the gig as well. He's got this way of pulling you into this whole thing.
Yes,
I mean, that is something he gets from Roy as well. I think it's the gig as an event. It's not just the music; it's the jokes and everything else. It pulls you in a way that some performers don't, I think.
Yes, because it enables you to warm to the personality behind the voice, behind the guitar. They're not just another figure standing there on stage. And I know that some artists today do sort of have that criticism levelled at them. I mean, I'm a one band that I think are amazing, and the Kings of Leon.
Yeah.
They rock, man. But they always, you know, some of their critics will have that. Well, you know, they just, Caleb Followell stands there on stage. He doesn't really have a lot of engage with the audience all that much. But with them, they're a band. It's a different thing that, you know, the guys are on stage, they can just really I don't feel personally anyway, they need to have a lot of chat and think with the audience. Just play the songs, man. But when you're just one guy on a stage
with a guitar, it's a different dynamic, isn't it? In a rock situation, the music is kind of everything and bludgeons its way through regardless, whereas, as you say, one man and a guitar, it's a very different sort of feeling to it. I know, obviously, Nick, when he started out, was doing stuff with Darren, and I interviewed Darren last year, it will be, actually, by the time this goes out, and Darren said that he had had a lot of input and a lot to do with the Seed album, and had put up some of the finance for it. But then, of course, Nick got involved with Glenn Tilbrook and did a lot of Squeezy-type stuff. How did you eventually become his PR? Because obviously, you know, we wind forward a few years after those early days. How did it all come about?
Ah, well, after that last gig at Bungie's in 1995, we didn't see or speak to each other for another 10 years.
Well, that's the gap I'm in.
There was no argument, there was no... I don't know. It just, sometimes I'm a firm believer in fate and destiny. And I think sometimes, however much you may think that you are in charge of, and you've got your destiny, and you can see your path plotted out ahead, sometimes it's almost like if something or someone is just saying, no, I think you're going to just make a slight diversion here. You're going to go off in this direction. So after 1995, I would come and I would sort of check in every so often. I'm talking about maybe once every couple of years, not
right.
as many times, about 12 times a month as I may go to gigs now.
Yeah.
But just to check, okay, he's still there. He's, he's doing okay. Mm. But I never actually sort of, we never spoke, or I never sort of went and spoke to him, and I it just didn't feel the need to, really.
Right.
And obviously, other things happen in your life, things intervene, and
yes.
things draw your way. So although, and I didn't buy all the albums, sorry, Nick, I hadn't bought all the albums. I think I kind of had gone off, I'd listened to Smithereens and kind of thought, because I had Seed on the Kennel.
Well, that's a whole separate discussion.
And then when I got Smithereens, that was like...
I don't care for that album very much, personally.
Yeah,
but
I
mean,
I do like some of it
yeah.
now. But no, that I sort of... So I hadn't had all the albums, so I wasn't sort of... In that intervening 10 years, I wasn't sort of holed up in my... Garrett somewhere with my little Harper shrine, lamenting the fact that I'd never become Nick Harper's PR and that my life was totally ruined and a mess.
Clutching your copy of
order. By the time we came up to 95, I got into writing and I was doing other things.
Mm.
So at this point in 1995, a lot of things happened in that year. Probably a thing that made an inner change in me was 7/7, because I think anybody who was in London, in central London that day, even you were caught up in just the mayhem. And
I was there that day, and I walked around talking to people. It was a very strange day.
Mm. Well, that was a day that sticks out for me, because I never travel on the tubes or trains, yes, tubes, no. That particular day, I needed to get from where I live over to West London, because I was doing an interview with an old radio presenter, Nick Ferrari, mm-hmm. who had has and still has a radio show on LBC in the morning. And his show finishes at 10 a.m.
Right.
And we were due to do the interview when he came off air. So the only way for me to get over there at that time was to travel on the tube.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wouldn't have otherwise done. So to get there, I had to go from Baker Street on Hammersmith and City Line to the station.
Mm.
So, yes, the timing. I was on the train that pulled into Edgware Road, that got behind the train that blew. And it was, I think, it was the initial, the noise, the then the silence, and then just... sort of everything of it, having to go through the train and on the tracks, and just the acrid smell of burning metal and everything, and then just getting out through the station, and then just be one. I mean, at that time there was not, it was still the full force I had, but then you couldn't get anywhere. All you started then hearing was just wailing sirens everywhere.
Mm.
Hundreds of people just milling around because there were no trains, all the buses. And then you started hearing these things. There's a bomb on a bus, there's a bomb at this station, a bomb at that station, there's people are injured. There's a bomb on two buses, three buses you were hearing. So you just wanted to get out of the air and you weren't sure how to. And then obviously later just getting, watching it on the news, just the whole thing of that day. And I think what that, the internal shift for me, that it was just the thought of there but for the grace of. If I had have been 1 minute earlier, I would have been on that train, the train that was hit and going into Edgware Road. That could have been me. And I think it just brought home to me just how transient and how precious life is. And just the thing of, why waste time? And I just thought all those people that went out to work that morning and wouldn't be going home that night. And just to say, to people that you care about them, tell them while they're there, that you love them, that you care about them. And so that was, all that kind of thing was going on inside my head, and just sort of, this is my life. This is a change for me.
And it's so, no rehearsal. That's
yes. And so what happened, that was what the July, and then this it was just sometime, probably a matter of weeks after that, I was talking to one of my editors, and we were just knocking about ideas for subjects that we might use, ideas that I had for features. And just out of my head, and I don't know where it came from, because I certainly hadn't been thinking about him, or was Nick Harper. And as soon as I said it, I was like, oh my God, why did I mention Nick? Where did that come from? Yeah. And thinking, oh, well, you know, perhaps he'll just ignore that. But the editor said, Nick Harper, yeah, you know, tell me a bit about him. Yeah, that sounds quite interesting. Right. Do you think you can get him? And it was like, oh my God, what have I let myself in for now? You know, just... So I said, okay, well, you know, he can only say no, I guess. So I made an approach through a third party, and they said, well, they'd pass the message on, and, you know. So I waited, and I waited, and waited, and then I called again and said, can you tell me what's happening? Will, you know, will Nick do it or not? And waited, and waited a bit longer. So I said, again, you know, I know now this is what Nick tends to do sometimes. So I waited, and it just went on for a couple of months, and I just got to the point, and inside I just thought, that's, you know, I was either just getting up to that point where I thought, that's it, it's my cutoff point. Right. You know, I've made the inquiry, I tried twice. If he's not interested, that's it.
Yes.
Forget it. And it was just at that point, or just shortly afterwards, that I got a call from him, and mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, just, you want to do it? Let's get it together. But for that telephone call, I would not be sitting here talking to you today. Mm. None of this over the last 3 years would have happened. Mm. I know. Yes, I probably would still have been writing in some way, but all this PR and everything, the fantastic experiences I've had over the last few years and the people I've met, none of that would have happened.
It's
at
one
all.
Of those
because
pivotal
that,
events,
I had made
it?
The decision, and if he hadn't have called, I wouldn't have done the interview. I probably wouldn't have gone to see him on that tour. I may have seen him perhaps at a gig sometime over these last few years, but I probably wouldn't have gone and spoken to him because I thought, well, he didn't damn well phone me. He didn't want to do the interview.
He's not interested.
So it would have just gone on, and my life would have been quite different. But as it is, you know, I'm living in a dream, I guess, what I wanted to do. But I didn't. Anyway, so going back to then, he called me, so... Okay, ball's back in my court. And it just felt like, you know, as I was saying, that fate and destiny decided, no, this is going to happen. This is flowing. So we met, we went to the gig and arranged to meet to do an interview, which was another interview, how we sort of really got to know each other the first time around by doing an interview. So then I'm coming back and it's the same thing. And we started off doing, prior to a gig he had in London, in probably one of the most noisiest bars in Islington.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just impossible to really sort of talk a lot. So we did half the interview then. And then we arranged, we did the second part after a gig. I think it was in Chester.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the second part of that interview probably was, you know, it was quite a different thing because Nick was obviously feeling more relaxed. It was it was after a gig. The pressure was off, you know, it was sort of early hours of the morning. And I think he probably gave and was more open than he has been a lot of times. But there again, you're always aware that... of how much you can use. And sometimes I sort of think, well, I know that I've done interviews with some people and I've been aware that they've kind of switched off and they're not talking to me any longer as the journalist. They're talking to me there as me. Mm. And you are in a bit of a quandary then because you think, well, theoretically... this is on record. They haven't asked for copy approval, so you can use what is there. But then you also think, well, I know some of those things perhaps are a little bit too personal that that person wouldn't like to have those displayed to the world, even though it probably, from the journalist's point of view, it could be a much better
But it's well, ethical in a way, isn't it? It's a case of knowing what's public and what isn't. And
yeah.
You get a feel for it, I think. I mean, I always give people the chance to, in my small way, listen to what we've done and say if they don't want anything on there. But very rarely
it's
do.
Hard, you know, sometimes to do that. You sort of think, well, it's a problem. So anyway, we did this second evening, which was a good one, but there were some things, you know, I thought, not because they were scandalous or anything like that, but just because I think they came a little bit, he was a little bit more revealing of himself than perhaps he would want to have on public display. So did the end. So anyway, interview was in the bag. That was done. I was still at that point. I was like, well, okay, do the interview. Maybe go to a couple of gigs, but then bye, see you in another 10 years. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
But again, you know, fate works its way in. And obviously it was decided. I felt two things happened that kind of reeled me in. Like something was saying, no, you're going to be around for a little bit longer yet. This is how it's meant to be. And what happened that around the same time, Roy was actually doing a gig down in Brighton, at which I went down to see. And after the gig, we're just standing there having a chat with him, and I mentioned that I'd just seen Nick a night or two before, and I'd interviewed him, etc.
Right.
And there was a local promoter overheard me saying this to Roy, and he stopped me a bit later and he said, well, you know, I heard what you were saying. He said, I'm trying to put on a gig down here for Nick early next year, which is 2006. Would you be interested in sort of helping out, doing some PR and stuff for the gig?
Oh, I see, right.
So I said, well, okay, yeah. You know, if Nick does it, yeah, I'll help out. So couple of weeks later, he called me and said, yeah, you know, it's on, we're doing that. So that was one thing I'd kind of given my word that I would help this promoter to sort of get some publicity for the gig. So that was one thing. Another thing that a friend I got to know, he had a couple of contacts. There was a radio station that was interested in doing an interview with Nick, and one of his media friends was interested in doing a print interview. And he said to me, well, look, I've got these friends, you know, they're really desperate to do something with Nick. How do I, you know, make the approach? Because Nick at that time just had a promotion person that he sort of brought in because he just brought Treasure Island out. So it was just sort of for a short 3 month period to do promoting the album, but it wasn't an ongoing thing. So as I say, this friend asked me, well, I've got this, how do I get to Nick to make this approach? So I said, well, I'll pass it on to this guy, if you like. And which is what I did. But then I found out that he said, well, my contract's finished, basically. You know, I'm not working with Nick any longer.
Right.
So I thought, okay. So I phoned up the radio person and just sort of to find out a bit more what they wanted. So I passed it on to Nick. And that's what happened. I ended up passing it on to Nick and by saying, look, there's these things, you know, do you want to do it? So that's how I became involved in that. So there were those two things that led me to be involved, and then of course, you know, I was sort of talking to the producer and the presenter and this other press guy and sort of liaising between them and between Nick and thinking, and then sort of went on my thinking, and obviously helping out with the press for the gig that Nick did down in Sussex. And so I was kind of thinking, I kind of like this. It still wasn't, you know, at that point there was nothing in my mind about doing PR or anything like that at all. But gradually it sort of thought, yeah, I kind of like this.
You found a situation where you enjoyed doing something and it obviously played to some of your skills and it grew from there, I suppose.
Yeah. And then it just got to, but I thought, well, I'm going to have to say, because I knew Nick didn't have anyone doing PR, so I just sort of said, well, you know, what do you think? Talk to Nick about it. What do you think? And he was a bit sort of like, I think he thought sort of, well, having his own personal PR was a bit kind of grand, you know, and a bit naff, you know. He was losing street cred, you know. It all sounds a bit highfalutin, doesn't it? So, oh, that's my PR. But he said, well, yeah, okay. So I think he probably thought at that time I was just, oh, maybe one-off interview here or there.
Yes.
Or maybe, you know, very little. And I just went full steam ahead, and certainly in 2006, and we were still working on the back of the promoting Treasure Island at that time. Just, it was like there were just interviews coming out of left, right and centre that we were doing.
If I just say from an outsider's point of view, it was very, very apparent when you started doing stuff that suddenly there was somebody on board that really wanted him to succeed and wanted to make this huge impact. And the difference between what happened then and what had happened before was like night and day. Not to demean anybody's work before then, but you really, you know, went for it 100%.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was, yes, and I did it for, not because I was, because it was, I had that, or even though, you know, that sort of 10-year period where I hadn't sort of thing, I still had that core. I came back and still I realised from the first gig that I saw again that, you know, obviously he had matured and had been out on the road for a long time, and he had now got his act together, and but I still had that core belief in him, and the same as I'd felt all those years ago. And it's just, I just wanted to do whatever I could and to just be involved. I mean, if I know we shouldn't have regrets, but if I have sort of one regret, it's that I it didn't come together back in those early years when.
But you never know how it would have worked out.
It obviously, again, you know, it wasn't meant to be at that time. Mm. And so anyway, then we come up to 2006, and that just sort of went through and sort of doing the stuff, and then gradually, you know, sort of really through MySpace and people getting to know me, who I was, they started saying, well, you know, I'm a new artist. we need, you know, we're desperate for some PR help. And, you know, and this kind of got to the point where, you know, today I probably get about at least a dozen inquiries a week saying, right, oh, you know, we're interested, we need some PR, could you listen to us because we, you know, we need some help and this kind of stuff. And that's kind of what, and certainly over the last year, 18 months, that I sort of thought I've wanted to sort of expand a bit, and there are other artists that I've got to know that I sort of, I'm, you know, again, feeling enthused about them, that I want to do something.
I was going to ask you that. Presumably, so you only take on stuff that you have some sort of connection with, is that right? Or do you just treat it as a job sometimes? Does it always have to be something that you feel enthusiastic about?
The people that I'm working with right now, the people that I've seen and I've liked, but at the same time there are a lot other artists that I've seen and liked, and I've, to a certain extent, but liking someone and going out buying their records or seeing their gigs is one thing. To try and sell that brand is something entirely different. Right. There's got to be, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a musician or whether it's baked beans or car insurance or Rice Krispies, you've got to look at it and say, what is the USP here? What is there that I can market, that I can sell about this particular brand? And sometimes, you know, it isn't there. I look at people and I will see them and I think they're okay, but, and they're nice people as people, but where can I see myself placing this? What, you know, and I'm thinking in terms of radio and press, what can I do? Where's the point that I can...
You need some sort of hook or some sort of affinity,
and quite often there isn't. And sometimes I can see that because I can sort of look at the bigger picture and can see where I can go with them on that style. So yes, it's got to be fundamentally, I've got to feel it in my heart that there is something there with those people, that I don't just like them as, and they're nice people, but there's, you know, there's a good solid product there, and something that certainly if I'm going to be working with them on the PR side, that I can, I know I've got a chance of having some getting somewhere with.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Okay, so So that was part one. Part two will be next month. I hope you enjoyed that. And we could delve further into the role of a PR and what Lynn gets up to and other bands she's into and all that kind of stuff. And it's a pretty interesting second half. So look forward to that. Okay, now let's delve straight into the A to Z of Harper. This time round, it was Q. Now, Q is a tricky one. As far as I've been able to find, no Roy Harper song begins with Q. I started to wonder what on earth I would do about it. And in fact, I put out a Twitter status message saying, I don't know what to do for Q. And I got some suggestions, actually. Andy Watterson said, what about HQ? And he came up with a whole bunch of other stuff. Various other people made suggestions. Vicky suggested that I pick a quintessential Roy Harper track, which was actually quite a good suggestion. Others said, why don't you talk a bit about Q magazine and their terrible treatment of Roy in days gone by? And I thought about that, but that doesn't really give me much in terms of what to play for music. So I suddenly had this sort of very strange injection of lyrics in my mind while I was thinking it over. And the lyrics are from 10 years ago. There are men employing men, employing men, employing men, employing men, employing men, who fill in forms, employing men, that forms a queue of paperwork, clear stretching out into the murk, so that nine temps don't produce, holding ransom, calling truce, and looking dangerous. Now that seems to me to be quite appropriate for these economic ridiculous times that we are living in, and the whole absurdity of the world economy and the way that banks have completely stitched us up, so that's why I am going to play 10 years ago. I'm going to play the version from Commercial Breaks, not the one from Unknown Soldier. I actually think the Commercial Breaks one's a bit better. It's a little bit rawer, and I like the guitar on it.
Scribble balls on notice boards, and the old way hierarchy
That was 10 years ago from Commercial Breaks. Now, a little bit of listener feedback. I didn't get very much feedback, actually, after the second part of the Bill Musial interview. What I did get was generally positive, and a lot of people said how nicely he came across in the sort of spoken medium, because a lot of us have heard, or read rather, his email missives in the past, and he had a very dense style. He sort of wrote in a particularly cryptic way, and it needed a lot of effort to get into, and I think perhaps that made some of us less able to hear the message of what he had to say. And he's obviously a very intelligent bloke, and has some very good, worthy opinions on stuff, and I think the interview really drew that out of him. I particularly like the second part where we talked more about politics and, you know, the world issues side of things. But I think the feedback is summed up by a forum message from Sean. He says, great podcast, love the way Bill describes his Harper addiction. I can relate a lot to that. Great choices of songs too. Probably a lesser played psychopath, and also Playing Prison. What an excellent Harper tune. Nice one, Paul and Bill. Especially enjoyed the ranting, raving and drooling. P.S. I was at the Albert Hall for Stormcock 2. Sorry, Bill. Sean's talking about the ranting and raving was, of course, me having a right old moan about these idiots that had contacted me on MySpace to try and get me to promote their white supremacy bullshit. I thought it might be nice to talk about the other side of MySpace this time round, because after the last podcast, I was contacted by James Hollingsworth, who is a musician. And you can find out all about James at jameshollingsworth.com. And I'll put links to that in the show notes. He also is active on MySpace as well, which is linked to from his main website. So you can tunnel in there and play samples of his music and all that kind of stuff. He got in touch because he'd started listening to the podcast and was influenced by Roy's music. In fact, I asked him about this and he says, I first saw Roy when I was at Swansea University in 1991-ish at the time of the Once album. His set at the time used a lot of sound effects and he made me realise how much is possible with just one acoustic guitar. His edge as an artist was also a great influence during a very formative period for me. I was studying marine biology, but ended up as a professional musician, mostly with just an acoustic guitar, as it happens. Now, James was kind enough to send me a CD, and I said, OK, I'll bung one of your tracks on the podcast, especially as a Roy Harper-influenced musician. I think people would be interested to hear what sort of stuff you do. James does an awful lot of gigs. If you look at his website, he's got an amazing amount of gigs, and I asked him how that fitted in. When I interviewed Nick Harper last year, Nick said that he made most of his money from gigs, and the CD sales actually was very much second class. And I asked James if that was the same for him, and he said yes, most of my income is gig fees too, which is why I mostly play pubs at the moment. He also gets some money in for CD sales every month, but it certainly isn't enough to pay a mortgage, let's put it that way. He says, my plan is to do more supports and folk clubs, but initially there's no money in these, so I've been developing a decent pub circuit first. My plan for 2009 is to get up to Scotland and make a foray or two into Europe to test the water there. In the download age, there's a constant dribble of money from download sites, but as yet this doesn't cover a round at the pub even every month. For example, on Rhapsody, I get 0.009 cents per song played. It seems there's so many musicians competing for attention these days, so the main problem for many of them is getting enough gigs. I get quite a few emails from people asking how I get all these bookings, and without going into talk about quality, the short answer is a lot of time on the phone and massive use of spreadsheets. Busy guy. And James, I really enjoyed talking to you on email about this, and maybe at some point in the future we'll get you on in an audio fashion and have a proper chat with you. But anyway, to give you a taste of what James is all about, here's a track from his album Coming Home to Stay. This is called Still Lights Up the Rain. Thank you.
follow the stars in the city skies. Amber reflections banished them from our eyes as we sit here smiling in the Garden of Eden.
So that was Still Lights Up the Rain from the album Coming Home to Stay by James Hollingsworth. JamesHollingsworth.com is where to go if you like that and want to find out more about James. Cheers, mate. Okay, credits. This podcast is issued under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim that you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. And the James Hollingsworth music is used by kind permission of James Hollingsworth and again is not for copying or redistribution. If you want to help the podcast, you can review us on iTunes as always. Lots of people subscribe through iTunes and there is a review system on there. And the better reviews we get, the more people will listen. If you want to make a donation, there's a PayPal button on stormcock.net. Feel free to use it if you've got money burning a hole in your pocket. Now, I do really like voicemails, and I hardly ever get any. If you want to send me an MP3 or similar of a message you'd like me to play on the podcast, please do so. Email me at pd@stormcock.net. Be delighted to receive those. If you can't make MP3s and fancy using a plain old telephone, the number to call is 01223 850282. If you're not in the UK, plus 441 223 850282. Limit your messages to 90 seconds or less, or you'll get cruelly cut off in your prime. Now, we've already run late, so this whole podcast will not fit on one audio CD. Terribly sorry to those of you that burn CDs, to apologise. The interview rang long and I can't stop talking this time round, goodness knows why. So I'm going to finish with one more Roy Harper track. And the other option for Q for the A to Z of Harper was to play quirky songs. And I started playing some of the less known or older songs, weird songs, ones that sort of, you know, aren't the classics. And for some reason, Ballad of Songwriter leapt out at me this time round. Now, that's a bonus track on the CD release of Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith. And it's from very early in Roy's career. And I like it. It's fun. Okay, so we'll finish with that. And I bid you goodbye now until February 2009. Again, I hope you had a fantastic new year. Hope the hangovers go soon. And on a serious note, I know some of you have been having financial problems, job problems and so on in the last few weeks, few months. And the message I have for you is hang on in there, things will get better. And, you know, fingers crossed, everything will work out okay. Just hang on. See you in February.
Giving you the loving muses that cram the head he always loses. Inside the tightrope explanation of the graceful living that is there for everyone to share. If you can be night fighter, songwriter. Fight up!